QSO Today, episode 538, Will Everett, N5OLA. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, ham radio? Do people still do that? This podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. Just a reminder that the response to my amateur radio events calendar has been great. It is now updated with the latest events worldwide. Please add your ham radio events to it, no matter how small or local. You can get to it from the banner link on the show notes page. This calendar is updated by you, and I hope that it will become the most comprehensive amateur radio events calendar on the internet. Please use it and update it with your ham radio events. As I'm getting back into the swing of things since my recent illness, I'm updating all of the systems and public-facing QSO Today projects, like the ham radio calendar. Of course, in this process, I have broken some of the automation that was hiding in the background while adding some new systems built with the help of my Hermes agent and Claude cowork. Please bear with me if something does not work quite right and send me a message to fix it. I appreciate your patience and support. Bill and Pete at the Solder Smoke podcast refer to my guest today as the Heathkit Guru of South Texas, a mantle that Will Everett, N5OLA, wears with pride. After returning to civilian life as a reporter and aid worker in Afghanistan in 2015, Will relicensed in 2019 and took his passion for vintage Heathkit amateur radio transceivers to a new level, restoring them to their former glory before sending them on to new owners. Operating from South Padre Island, Will enjoys CW on his Heathkit HW101, finding quiet moments between running his coffee shops and pursuing his restoration passion. N5OLA is my QSO today. N5OLA, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Will?
4Z1UG, N5OLA, I am here.
Will, thanks for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Well, like most young ham radio operators, I was influenced by an older family member. I had a grandfather who was a radio guy during World War II. And when I was 12, I got shipped off to Nebraska to spend the summer with my grandparents. And when I wandered into my grandpa's basement, which was filled with old radios and test equipment, I was just enthralled. And that summer, I got to watch him on the air. I got to learn more about what's involved with ham radio and, you know, what would it mean to get a license? Could I get a license? I was only 12. And he said, yeah. You got to learn code. You got to learn theory. But here's a book. Let's go to the electronics store. Here's a tape. It'll help you learn Morse code. And by golly, the next year when I was 13, I had my ticket.
And what was your first call sign?
My first call sign was Kilo Alpha 5 Juliet Quebec Hotel. And I was an active ham throughout my teenage years. And sadly, like many of us, college happened and life happened and ham radio went by the wayside for a while.
Right, but let's not jump over that period so fast.
Okay.
So you're 13 years old, you have your first license. What was the first rig that you had?
Well, I started out on probably the worst radio that a newbie could start out on, and that was the QRP rig. It was the Heathkit HW8. It's a fine rig for QRP, but when you're 13 and you don't know anything about radio propagation and you've got a crappy vertical antenna in the backyard with no radials and no antenna tuner and no Elmer nearby to help you, trying to get on the air with 1.5 watts is a martyr's task. And eventually I begged my father for a 100-watt HF radio, and he was working overseas at the time, and I can remember him sending me a letter with a bunch of $100 bills in it saying, here, get what you need. It was only $500, but I was able to get a Kenwood TS-520, and I loved that rig. At the time, it was pretty much state-of-the-art, and that's what I was on the air with throughout my high school years.
How about that? I still have my TS-520 sitting here as well for well over 45 years or so. So tell me, Will, so you're working with the vertical in the backyard, and where was the hometown? You were no longer in Nebraska. That was only where you visited your grandfather during the summer. Where was the hometown?
Yeah. Well, no, I was in Conroe, Texas, and that's about an hour north of Houston. Did not have any immediate family members who were hams, did not have anyone in the community that I could reach out to. There was no ham club at school. There was no online access, of course. So, I just read every issue of CQ and QST from cover to cover and just tried to learn as best I could. I was building a lot of Heath kits back then because working at McDonald's, everything I could afford, I would pour into getting a Heath kit because I just loved putting them together and I loved just being able to learn so much from those manuals. And of course, invariably, they wouldn't work and I'd have to ship them off to Grandpa and he'd send them back to me. And usually he would include some kind of modification, an extra button, an extra switch, an improvement on the original Heath design. And sure wish I still had those radios on hand, but again, life happens, and a lot of times we sell these rigs for the expediency of the moment, and boy, I sure regret it.
That's right. I can think of a few of mine as well. So tell me, what were the radios, the Heath kits that you were buying and building as a kid?
So the first one was the HW8, and then I built an SW717 receiver, and from there, I did several, pieces of test equipment and whatnot, but the real challenge was the HW5400. That was a fully synthesized solid state rig, and it was amazing if you could build it. But it was so complicated. So there were so many components crammed into this tight chassis. And I did my best, but it didn't work. So I shipped it off to Grandpa. He fixed it, sent it back. And a few years later, I sold it. Stupid.
So it sounds to me, as we go farther, into your ham radio story, that when it came to the choices that you made for your education career, it wasn't in technology, was it? What was it that you studied, and what did you go off and do?
This was back around... I was 13 in 1980, so I was, I was doing all this in the early 80s, and this was at the very dawn of the personal computer boom, and my father, in his letters from overseas, he would beg me to get into computers. He said, you've already got this interest in ham radio, you know electronics, you're learning it anyway, get into computers. I never did. I was too crazy about literature, so I went into English lit and I went into a completely different direction from ham radio and electronics and electronic theory, but we make the decisions that seem right in the moment, and when you're in college and you're 19-20 years old, at that time ham radio kind of seemed like the stuff of youth, and It's funny how we look at things. Now, I would give anything to have all those years back so I could watch the evolution of ham radio for the last 30-something years. Because when I got back into it in 2019, I felt like Rip Van Winkle waking up into a different time, you know.
Okay. So where did you graduate in English literature, and what did you do with the degree? How did you spend those years?
I graduated from a small liberal arts college called Harding University in Arkansas, and later got my master's from the University of Southern California. But my early career was, it was in radio. It was just a different kind of radio. I became a national public radio presenter. I started a program which would blend classical music with literature, because I had also been an oboe player. And for 10 years, I did this radio program freelance, where I would read stories and weave in music on a similar theme. So I think radio kind of influenced that, you know, the magic of radio, the mystique of, you know, unseen listeners out there. I think that kind of drove that decision. But I did that for 10 years, and that morphed into doing radio journalism. I would go overseas and bring back stories for NPR and other radio magazines. And those were the early years of my career, very much influenced by ham radio, I think.
What was the most exotic story that you brought back to NPR?
I don't know if exotic is the word. I brought back a lot of weird stories, like when I was in India, there was a woman who was trying to get toilets for her village, and she was crazy about toilets. And I spent 2 days looking at toilets. Not exactly the kind of stuff that high drama is made from, but it was fun, and I got to go to a lot of cool places. And my interest began to focus on places like Pakistan and Afghanistan. And on my first trip to Afghanistan 20 years ago, I fell in love. I fell in love with that country. It was recovering from war. This was only 5 years after 9/11, and the Taliban had not yet come into their own. And things were fairly peaceful in the capital. And I fell in love with that place, and I decided I'm going to find a way to live here and work here. And it took a few years, but I eventually found a position with an aid program that needed somebody with writing skills and photography and podcasting skills. So I ended up living in Afghanistan and working there for a good 5 years.
And did you continue to create segments for NPR while you were there and during that 5-year period?
No, that was pretty much, that's where radio kind of went into an eclipse. Around 2010, I started working there full time, and that was pretty much the end of my radio days. Who was it that, I think Fitzgerald mistakenly said one time that there are no second chapters in American life. Well, I've had like 5 or 6 chapters, and none of them really bear a whole lot of comparison with what went before it. But, I feel like in my careers, there's always been a time for something and then a time for something new. And so, you know, I was ready to let radio go, you know, NPR radio, and focus on this aid work and meeting Afghan people and drilling into Afghan culture. And but I was also glad when, you know, radio made a resurgence 9 years later, 2019. It's been a life changer.
So let's, before we go there, can you tell me what the World War I Living History Project was? And what was your role in that?
So when I had my NPR program, it occurred to me, and I don't know where I got this idea, but one day I just thought, I wonder how many of these old World War I veterans are still around. We kept hearing about the Greatest Generation and World War II, but no one was talking about World War I. And when I did a little research, I realized like there weren't very many of those guys left. In fact, maybe less than 50 out of 4.5 million who signed up in the United States. So I started looking into that, thinking, man, I bet I could raise some money, interview the last veterans, and do a really cool documentary with that. I contacted Walter Cronkite's office and I said, hey, do you think Uncle Walter would like to host my documentary? And I told them about it. And at that time, it was just an idea, but his secretary said, I presented this to him and he loves it. If you can get your narration down and do your interviews, he'd love to read the narration. So with that in hand, I was able to rally a whole lot of funding, fly around, interview the last veterans. And this took some time. By the time I got out in the field and was interviewing these veterans, there were only about a dozen left. And so I was really scrambling to get those interviews in the can. These guys were between 105 years old and 114. And I think I really got in there just in the nick of time, because 6 months later, half of them were gone. And a few years later, they were all gone, of course. So that program aired Veterans Day 2006, and it had a huge response from the NPR community. It was a really great project, and I'm so glad I did it, because by the time the public kind of figured out, like, oh wait, we don't have very many World War I veterans left, all the good ones, the good interview subjects, were gone, and journalists were coming to me saying, hey, we need this material, this is valuable. And I'm still amazed that nobody went out and got this stuff. There should have been a really good, you know, a TV documentary or something. But, now, of course, with World War II, you're seeing a lot of that.
Well, I think it's interesting that that we probably have veterans from just about every situation in the world who, at least in the last 50 years, who may still be around. And their stories, like the ham radio stories, are worth preserving, don't you think?
Absolutely. The Library of Congress has something called the Veterans History Project, where they collect interviews with veterans. So anyone who's listening, if you've got a family member who served in Vietnam or World War II or Korea or wherever, sit down with a recorder or record it on your phone and do an interview with that family member and get it to the Library of Congress, and it will be held in perpetuity forever.
Isn't that amazing? So what was the pivot after Afghanistan? You were there 5 years, and then what happened?
Well, around 2015, my employer said, you know, things are getting kind of frisky out here. You may want to go back home and work remotely. This was at a time when the tide was starting to turn. The Taliban was growing. They were pushing into the cities. The suicide bombings were on the rise. I was living in a house with a shotgun and a German Shepherd and some armed guards down the street. And my employer said, you know, that just may not be good enough. And you can come live on the compound. I said, no, I'm going to go home. I'll work remotely. I don't want to live on a compound. I was in Kandahar on a compound that was attacked. And it was a 6-hour gun battle, and a suicide bomber blew himself up. And I was not going to go through that crap again. So I went home and started working remotely. And when I was living in this house, I had a houseboy who worked for me and whose life was in danger because of his employment for me. And I felt really bad about that. And when I got home, I said, you know, let me try to bring you over here, because you are really in danger. And he'd already had his collarbone smashed. And eventually I was able to get him over here as an asylum seeker, back when that sort of thing was even possible. Not possible now. And he and I, a couple years later, we started a coffee shop. He needed something to do, and he had a real mind for business, so we opened a coffee shop. And 9 years later, we now have two coffee shops and another one on the way, and he's living the American dream. So, go immigrants.
And where is the coffee shop You know, where is home now?
Home is South Padre Island, Texas. It's down on the southern tip of Texas. We are about 7 or 8 miles from the SpaceX launch site. So that's kind of our current claim to fame.
So you can sit in your coffee shop, drink coffee, and watch rockets take off.
You can feel them take off. The whole building will shake. The windows will rattle, and everyone runs out into the street thinking it's a it's an earthquake. And then up in the sky, you see this shimmering arrow piercing the clouds. It's really cool, except that it's really not good for our houses. But that's another story.
I'm sure you have to start. You'll have to probably make the houses out of a different material. Especially when they're talking about, you know, daily reuse.
Yeah, that's unimaginable.
It's unimaginable, but it may be possible. You know, you never can tell. Yeah. Who would think he could catch a rocket with a pair of tongs?
Right. So, isn't that crazy?
It's crazy. It's almost miraculous. Okay, yeah. So you have these two coffee shops. 2019, you have the urge to do ham radio. Again, what triggered that urge, and where did that go?
You know, it was just an evening of nostalgia. I think I was watching a movie, and I saw, I think it was the movie Frequency, and there was a Heathkit radio in the movie, and I'm like, dang, I recognize that. Wonder whatever happened to Heathkit. I wonder what's going on in ham radio these days, man. That was a long time ago. And I start researching, and suddenly there's FT8. What's that? I remember radio teletype, but suddenly there's all this, you know, people are using their computers as radios and SDR, and wow, crazy. But as I started getting interested in it again, and that bug started gnawing at me, I wasn't driven really by the new stuff. I wanted to drill into the old stuff that I never quite mastered. You know, there's this memory of building a radio and then having to ship it to my grandfather because I was too dumb and uninformed to make it work on my own. And I thought, I wonder if I could master that stuff all these years later. And what better way to do it than with Heathkit, because they have the most fabulous manuals. Those manuals are so educational without even meaning to be. And so I bought the Heathkit HW101, which was the radio transceiver my grandfather used to use in his shack. That was his daily driver. And I bought the complete station from somebody on eBay. And the rest is history. I started going to ham fests. I started getting old HW101s and working on them and failing miserably. But, you know, the cool thing about the age in which we live is that we have this amazing online community of seasoned experts out there who are willing to teach you if you show an interest to learn. And so I started finding these online chat groups, the Antique Radio Forum. There's some Heathkit owners groups on Facebook, and there's a Yahoo group for Heathkit owners. And through those different chat groups, I was able to find people who could help me conquer my ignorance. And little by little, I started to figure things out. And that was, I guess it's been a full 6 years now. But now I have a channel on YouTube, and I'm trying to share what I've learned with other people and help, you know, people who are where I was 6 or 7 years ago, who want to make these rigs work again.
Okay, so the first rig you bought was the HW101. I remember that. That was, a 5-band HF transceiver. I think everybody my age, you know, wanted one of those, and that was, I think I'm maybe 10 years older than you. So at least in the early 70s, it was a popular rig. What do you do? So when you find an HW101, you found more than a few, it's my understanding. You know, what's the first thing you do with it? Usually these things are pretty cruddy, and if the guy smoked, it was probably, full of nicotine and everything else. What do you do with a rig like this when you bring it home?
Well, you nailed it. They are gritty, grimy, full of nicotine. A lot of times they've sat in an attic or a garage for decades. Because, the people who owned them, they often migrated to other rigs and put their HW-101 aside. And those rigs were very neglected. And if the owner died and the rig sat in storage for years, they can be in really, really bad shape. I've opened up these rigs and found rat droppings. I've found coax that have been gnawed by rodents and boards stained with urine. I mean, it's crazy how bad these rigs can be, but those are the ones I like. I like getting a really, really nasty transceiver and bringing it back to life just to see if I can do it. And I'll film every step of the process just so others can see, like, look how bad this is. If I can make this thing work, you can make your HW-101 work too. And so the first thing, is I open it up. If the thing is all grimy and full of dirt and nicotine, I'm going to put it in the sink and scrub it. I'm going to spray it out, get some dish soap and a big paintbrush, and just go after those boards, and then stick it in the oven, dry it out for a few days, and it's amazing, amazing how those boards will sparkle like new again. And then from there, you have to go through the steps of troubleshooting. You turn it on. Does it work? Yes, no. Does the receiver work? Yes, no. You just go stage by stage and try to work out the problems.
Now, do you use a variac or something like that to bring the line voltage up slowly so that the caps don't blow up in your face?
No, there are typically two paper caps on an HW-101 that are 20 microfarads each. Those are really the only ones you need to worry about. And I've never seen one actually explode, and I've probably done 100 restorations on those rigs. You do need to bring the power supply up with a variac because those have big can capacitors, electrolytics that are potentially all dried out. And if you apply too much current too fast, they will blow up sometimes or smoke. And so I do bring those up slowly on the variac, but I typically will just rebuild the power supply with new caps and not even mess with the old ones because those caps are 55 years old. And so electrolytics, I always replace them. There's a lot of debate about that. Why replace it if it's working? Well, it's working today, it may not be working tomorrow, and it's old. So
Right, and it's a cheap repair. It's cheap
yeah.
insurance.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that all of those old rigs actually did have outboard power supplies for the high voltage and the heater voltages and stuff like that. In the
Right.
HW-101, did that live in the accessory speaker or was it under the desk?
Oh, the power supply. Yeah,
Right.
the power supply, either way, it will fit inside the SB600 speaker cabinet, or it can just sit by itself under the desk, whatever. But yeah, you definitely want to recap those things. It's not difficult. There's lots of recap kits out there, and it's a fun weekend project.
Can you find, obviously that seems to me that the cases, the front panels maybe need to be reworked. What do you do to make it look like a brand new radio again?
Well, if the cabinet's been all scuffed and scratched, I do have a custom Heathkit paint, and I sell it on eBay. But I use that when I need to repaint a cabinet. I'll sand it down and prime it, paint it. The front panel, if the front panel is in bad shape, like the silk screening is faded or whatever, you can buy overlays on eBay that look almost exactly like the original. You just pop all the knobs off, remove the meter and the escutcheon in the middle, and put this overlay, and it looks like a brand new rig. So there's lots of workarounds when you've got a rig that's heavily damaged. But, you know, I'm finding that, you know, apart from minor scrapes and scratches, I don't have to do that too often, because a lot of these things, they're really bad inside, but they're not all that bad on the front panel. So, yeah, you do what you have to do to get the restoration you want. And there's so many resources available online for that. And, of course, the best resource is just having a good collection of parts radios, which I have in abundance. I have guest rooms piled up with radios in my house. I don't have company anymore because I just have nowhere to put them. The house is just overrun with radios. But I'm not a hoarder. I fix these radios up, and I try to get rid of them because they're no good to me just sitting here restored and ready to run. I would like them to get into the hands of someone who can appreciate them.
Now, have you found parts, you know, like carbon comp resistors, or whether even use those anymore? But have you found part supplies for those old radios in addition to the chassis that you have? It seems to me that you know, some of those older components need to be replaced with newer components.
Yeah, some of those older components are as they say, unobtainium. You can't get them anymore. Things like variable capacitors, you know, like the loading coil is a 3-gang loading capacitor. You can't find that online. No way. It's very specific to that rig. So you do need parts rigs for stuff like that. But for components, you can get your ceramic caps and your silver micas online. You can get them new, old stock. You can get them brand new. You can find any kind of capacitor you need for that rig. And as for resistors, a lot of the older Heathkit had the carbon comp resistors, which tend to drift up with age. And around, I would say, 1978 or so, Heathkit realized, like, yeah, these carbon comps are kind of obsolete. Let's replace them with carbon film. And so the later iterations of the HW101 came with carbon film resistors, which are kind of a beige color instead of the dark brown of the carbon comps. When you get a rig that has those carbon film resistors, you know you're in for a treat, because 99% of those carbon film resistors are still going to test just fine. So, but you've got others to replace. You've got there are wire wound resistors that have to go, and they're about 5 electrolytics that you want to replace. And then you want to test all those resistors just to be sure, because every now and then you'll find a dud, and that one dud resistor can totally throw you off the rails. So that's just part of the process.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now, and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. And how much time would you say that you spend on the process every day? Is this a full-time job for you now, or is this in between running the coffee shops? Is this something that you do every day, or, you know, when the spirit moves you?
Well, I try to get into the shack once a day, and it's usually toward the end of the day, because the demands of the day just don't allow me to be in there when the sun is out. I would love to, but, you know, I've got 2 coffee shops. I've got a pretty active life, you know, and I've got to tend to business. And when I'm in the shack and the sun's out, I feel kind of guilty, like, wow, guilty pleasure. Should I be in here right now? This is fun. So I will get in there during the day when I can. I do have a lot of repair jobs coming in these days, which preclude doing my own restorations. I hear from people who watch my YouTube channel, and they're like, you know, I followed the steps. I just can't get this thing running. Will you fix it? And yeah, I will for a price. But if it's that important, send it to me. I'll fix it. And those are kind of stacking up. And sometimes a repair job can take, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours, depending on how bad it is. And, you know, I don't make a lot of money on those repair jobs. I try to be fair with people. A lot of the folks who want those rigs fixed are old timers who just want to rekindle that old flame, you know, while they still can. And I'm not going to overcharge those guys. You know, I've seen repair companies charging $40 an hour for bench time. And, you know, no one's going to spend $800 to get their HW101 fixed. So I do it for about $200. And sometimes they don't take very long, and sometimes they take 10, 12 hours. But that's okay. You know, I'm not worried about it. It's not the money so much. I like to see those things come back to life.
So do you find that there's a large enough community of Heathkit owners or people who aspire to own old Heathkit radios that do you have any problems getting rid of the rebuilt radios that you have finished?
I typically sell them on QRZ, and when I post a restored Heathkit, it's usually there for about 2 hours before I get a message saying I want it, and then I take it down. So every now and then, every blue moon, I'll post something and the right person doesn't see it, and it'll be on there for a few days, but eventually someone's going to buy it. And sometimes I'll post it to my YouTube channel and so that my subscribers can see, like, hey, I've got this HW16 that I've just restored. If you're interested, let me know. So sometimes I'll make them available to subscribers first, but they always find a home. What's sad sometimes is that the person who buys it is very old, and maybe a year or two later, I get an email from a family member saying, hey, you fixed this radio up for Grandpa, and he's gone now, and we don't know what to do with it. And so I try to guide them into selling it, and that's always very sad when somebody goes SK.
Unavoidable, I'm afraid. Someone told me the other day, if you're born, you can't help but die. So
yeah,
there Sadly. Seemed to be a simple wisdom in that. Anyway.
But it is kind of sad that a lot of the people who buy these rigs tend to be on the older side. Now and then, someone in their 50s will buy one, but it tends to be 50 and up. You know, I don't have any 30-year-olds buying old Heathkits, and I wonder what that means. I don't know what that means. It could be that, you know, they need to come up through the ranks a bit before they become interested in vintage technology. I don't know. I hope that they remain in demand, but I will tell you that the average age of my buyers tends to be, I don't know, mid-70s, maybe early 70s. Hmm.
Well, you know, that makes sense because that was the, you know, those were the radios of our day, you know, when we were kids. But it seems to me, and maybe I'm, you know, projecting, but that if there was some kind of video or some kind of history of the Heathkit organization and the amateur radios that were developed by them, some of the models, you know, the later models, I've never heard of. So that you know, that you put together. So I'll be interested in seeing when we're done, you know, looking those up and seeing what those are. But I think, you know, for a lot of kids, these radios are out of context, and I guess the only place that you might see them in context could be, you know, like maybe an open field day event or in a science museum or something like that, where there's a whole, you know, set or maybe even a Heathkit museum. Do you think you have enough pieces to make a Heathkit amateur radio museum?
Boy, you'd almost think so. I find rigs on back shelves that I've forgotten about, and I'm like, dang, what a cool, I've had this all along, damn. You know, I've got so many of them. But again, I'm really trying not to be a hoarder. I'm trying to just get them out. It's a slow process. And usually I find these rigs in big estate sales. I'll find out that, okay, there's a guy who's, he died, his son is trying to sell off the collection, and there's, you know, maybe 20, 25 different rigs, all Heathkit. If that's the case, I'm there. I will fly out there. I will rent a van. I will bring them home if the price is right. And, you know, by the time you've spent all that to acquire them, you know, and then you spend time fixing them up, you may not make a lot on them, but what a joy. What fun, you know. That's where it's at for me. It's all about the passion. I love it. I want to make a little bit on it. I don't want to feel like I'm losing money on this hobby, but that's not really the main thing for me.
Do you operate? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of ham radio operators who build. I'm one of the ones who like working on stuff more than operating. So do you actually operate ham radio? And when you operate ham radio, what mode do you prefer, and what radio do you use?
I'm a CW guy. Always have been, always will be. I do about 95% of my QSOing with CW. And sometimes I'll do it with my HW101. Sometimes I'll switch on the HW5400, which I recently acquired. Love that rig. And, you know, sometimes I do have more modern, or I've got a Kenwood 440 that I'll use sometimes. But yeah, I do like using vintage. I like fixing up vintage. I like going in that shack on a cold winter morning and just turning on all those tube rigs and turning on the linear and just enjoying that tactile, sensual experience of being surrounded by hot tubes.
That sounds pretty amazing. Well, now that you're thinking about building the third coffee shop, maybe you could have a Heathkit wall in that third coffee shop so that the people coming in and sipping coffee will find out that ham radio is alive and well, and that you have a passion for the Heathkit radios. What do you think about that?
I think that's a great idea. I think I need to somehow use the coffee business as a vehicle for letting people know what this hobby is all about. I have radio operator license plates on both of my vehicles, and people are constantly asking me, what is that? I even had a police officer ask me one time, what does that mean? How could a police officer not know about ham radio? And it's just a sad fact that people don't quite get it unless they have the context of a grandparent or somebody that they distantly remember pounding the iron when they were a kid, you know. But if you don't have that context, it's a unicorn. Like, why would you tap out Morse code to talk to people when you have a cell phone? Well, it's like fishing. Why would you go fishing when you can go to the grocery store and buy your fish? Because you want to bait your line, you want to get in the boat, you want to acquire cool equipment, and you want to cast off and see what happens. It's the magic of dropping your lure in dark water and not knowing what's under there and what's going to bite. It's exactly the same feeling you get when you turn on that rig on a late night and you send out CQ and you get a response from South Korea, you know. It's a thrill and it's a joy. And I would like to use the coffee shops as a vehicle. I just need to work out how to do that.
Right. So it gives you a chance to expose ham radio to the people drinking your coffee, but also control as your license requires, you know, control access. But I think that's where young people, you know, might find it. If you have an iced coffee that you can sell to them on a hot summer day. They'll ride their bike over to your coffee shop and, you know, say, "Hey, Mr. Everett, what do you got on the radio?"
Yeah. And, you know, I think the key would be for them to see me doing it, because listening to Morse code doesn't mean a whole lot. But seeing somebody going back and forth with someone on the other side of the world and explaining what's happening, I think that would be thrilling for people, some people. Others just kind of like shrug, like, that's just weird. I don't get it. But yeah, I think you and I should go in the coffee shop business. Get over here.
You know, it's funny. Everyone thinks they can do the food business. And the fact that you have two coffee shops and you're thinking about a third means you figured out, you know, how to be one of the, you know, one of the 3% in the world who start a food business and are still in it after a period of time.
Yeah, well, my dad was in the restaurant business, and I knew right away I was not going to get into the restaurant biz. But we needed a coffee shop. Coffee shops were on the rise 9 years ago, of course, and I thought that just seems like an easy compromise to a restaurant. And so, you know, we do the coffee, we do pastries, and we make breakfast sandwiches from scratch. And it's easy. We train people. They do all the heavy lifting. And I just kind of walk in now and then and, you know, put a little oil over here, and tweak this screw over here, you know, just make sure that the machine is running smoothly. But it's pretty much self-driven.
That's pretty amazing. Do you find, as an aside, are coffee shops, at least your coffee shops, are they places where people gather on a regular basis? I mean, do you have South Padre Island regulars that come in and hang out in order to find out what the latest gossip is on the island and who was born, who died, you know, that kind of stuff? Mm-hmm. Or are they people that bring their laptops in and use your electricity all day?
Well, we have both. You know, we have the coffee clatch. We have the, you know, the old timers who come in and hang out in the mornings. If they want to meet up to talk about business, they'll say, "Hey, let's go to Karma." That's the name. Cafe Karma is the shop. And, you know, there aren't a lot of places where you can just go meet someone if you want to talk business, or if you want to, you know, just have a meeting spot to hang out. You know, you could go to a bar, but that's not in the morning, really. You could go to a restaurant, but that's noisy. Coffee shop is kind of like a good meeting point, and a lot of people use it. And yeah, we do get a lot of people who come in with their laptops. They'll buy a $2 tea and they'll nurse that thing for 5 hours, or until I go in back and switch off the Wi-Fi. But yeah.
You know, you spent your career telling other people's stories, you know, veterans, conflict survivors, musicians. Now you're on the other side of the microphone. How does it feel?
Wow. Well, you know, it's I'm just thankful every day for this latest advent of ham radio in my life. I'm thrilled to death that I rediscovered it, that it rediscovered me, and that, you know, that I've been able to take it to that next level of, you know, acquiring technical proficiency. That's been very gratifying to myself. But it's even more gratifying because I know that there are a lot of people watching these videos and who are benefiting and able to actually use these things to build on their knowledge. You know, I went into this not knowing anything. I was just so ignorant. And all I know is the stuff people have helped me learn. You know, I don't know this stuff because I'm so smart. I've just acquired it piecemeal, problem by problem. I keep really good notes. I document my efforts and my frustrations, and that's how I've learned. And it's just so gratifying being able to help other people. As we were talking, I shouldn't do this, but I glanced over at my computer and saw an email had popped in This is an email from a guy. I sold him two radios. Actually, no, he shipped two radios to me to be repaired. And he's writing to say how happy he is. But unfortunately, one of them has developed an S meter issue, and I'm going to have to help him with that. And that's okay. There's always service after the sale. That's just part of it. But knowing that this guy is using these rigs and having fun with them, that's super gratifying.
I know that that you got the attention of Bill and Pete over at the Solder Smoke podcast, who call you the Heathkit guru of South Texas. Do you wear that moniker comfortably these days?
I'll take it. I'll take it. We don't have a lot of hams in South Texas, and at least that I know of. So whether I'm the Heathkit guru of South Texas or anywhere, I'll wear that mantle with pride. Sadly, a lot of the people who used to fix up Heathkit gear are retiring, and there's a niche for people who know how to do this stuff, who can help others and, you know, fix their rigs. I'm kind of limited in what I can do. I can't just fix anything. And it's got to be a Heathkit because I need that manual. Got to have the manual. Don't send me a Drake or a Swan because I'm not going to know what I'm doing. But I think in a few years I'll be able to fix those too.
Although it pays to stay in the niche, perhaps.
I think, yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot to be said for the pursuit of mastery as opposed to simply knowing a little bit about a lot of different radios. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean. As a jack of all trades and master of none, I think before the end of my life, I'd like to be the master of one. So yeah. We'll see how that goes. What excites you the most about what's happening in ham radio now?
Oh, boy. Well, there is a resurgence of interest in vintage technology. Like I said, I do hear from mostly older people, but I'm just starting to hear from people who are a little bit younger, who kind of didn't experience the Heathkit period, and they're kind of wondering about that and like, this is interesting. And that excites me, seeing people who are interested in the older technology. I'm also excited that there are a lot more kits coming online now with QRP
sure.
Labs and even these, you know, these Chinese kits. They're cheap and they're not all that interesting to build, but you know, for about $20, you can build a frequency counter, and you know, it won't have a cabinet, and I don't know how long it's going to last you, but it works. And it's $20 on eBay. So those things are out there. And that's kind of exciting. I don't personally get excited about the digital modes and stuff like that. But I'm so grateful that it exists because it has brought a new generation of people into ham radio. And that's what they do. And that's cool. We can all coexist.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, isn't it? From the standpoint that ham radio is... I used to tell people that ham radio is like a three-ring circus, you know, with the major stuff in the, you know, in the three rings, you know, CW, single sideband, and, you know, maybe FM, you know, in the main tent. But the midway has 1,000 tents, and and that's what's exciting about ham radio. What do you want to say something about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, even though I'm into vintage gear, like I'm not a Luddite, I think it's really cool that all these new technologies are opening up. And I keep thinking about my grandpa. I remember in the early 80s, when the Commodore 64 first came out, he bought one. He learned how to write code for it. And he got that thing doing radio teletype with his Heathkit HW101. And I am that, you know, he was taking advantage of the technology of his childhood, but also of his present day. And I think if he was alive right now, he'd probably be doing some FT8. I think he'd be doing a lot more CW because he was blazing fast on his pedal. But I think he would be on FT8. So, you know, that's, I fully embrace all the technologies of ham radio, and I'm very grateful that there's so much variety now.
What advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, the tendency, I think, with a lot of new hams is to get all the bells and whistles. And that costs money. You know, if you want an ICOM 7300, if you want the waterfall, if you want the, I don't know, you can, if you've got the money and you want to go full tech, go for it. But if you don't have that kind of money, you can get a lot of radio for not a lot of money. I mean, just look at the prices of these, of the solid state rigs from the 90s, or something like a Kenwood 440, or, you know, something like that, or even a TS 520. Those are fun. Those are, they're hybrids. They do have, you know, the tube finals, but you do get, the feel of something that's kind of old and kind of new, you know? So I would advise people, like, hey, you don't have to get all the bells and whistles right away. You know, spend $300 and get a Kenwood, you know, from 30 years ago. It's going to work great, and learn on it. And you may want to go backward. You may want to get something that's a little more vintage, or you may want to go forward and get something with a waterfall and, you know, better digital compatibility or whatever. But whatever you want, this is a good time to get into ham radio, because depending on your budget, there's probably something out there for you.
Will, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. This was really a pleasure. And with that, 73.
Hey, 73, Eric. Thank you. It was a pleasure. And keep doing what you do. It's a great podcast.
Thank you. 73. That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Will. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an N5OLA in the search box at the top of the page. You can sponsor the transcription of this episode or any of the previous episodes by clicking on the transcription button on every show notes page. The cost is $75 per episode, regardless of the length. We will quickly transcribe the episode and give you credit for your sponsorship. Please send us the call sign of the podcast to make sure that we transcribe what you want. Remember that QSO Today is value for value. Please support our project by making a donation or becoming a listener sponsor today. Use our Amazon link before shopping at Amazon, as we receive a small commission on your Amazon purchases. Subscribe to our mailing lists, both my blog and the podcast, and forward the messages to friends and family who would enjoy QSO Today content. Promote us on social media and give us a 5-star rating and reviews whenever you are asked. QSO Today is available on every podcast player and venue, including Apple Podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, and Podcasting 2.0. Get a Podcasting 2.0 player to make it easy to get your next episode as soon as we publish. Until next time, this is Eric for Z1UG 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.